Hello, and welcome to Season 7, Episode 8 of Bad Gays, a podcast about evil and complicated queers in history. I'm Ben Miller, a writer, researcher, and member of the board of the Schwules Museum in Berlin.
And I'm Hugh Lemmy, an author and artist.
And last week we talked about Martha Hanau, the French swindler who conned millions of petty bourgeois citizens out of millions of their cash while driving fast cars and draping herself in fine jewelry. Who are we talking about this week, Hugh?
Today we're discussing the life of Qutbuddin Mubarak Shah, the 14th century leader of the Delhi Sultanate, whose brief reign was marked by bloodshed and war, and whose tortuous love life, guess what, eventually led to his downfall.
What a surprise. I love it when we cover brand new territory that we've never covered before.
So let's start with Mubarak Shah's family, as the story of the Delhi Sultanate at the time is nothing if not the sort of battling of bloodlines and dynasties, very Game of Thrones. His father was Alauddin Khalji, the 13th Sultan of Delhi, who had assumed his throne having first married the daughter of the Sultan, his uncle, who had founded the Khalji dynasty. Alauddin then revolted against his new father-in-law in 1296, and Alauddin's reign involved a lot of conflict, including rebuffing Mongol invasions and massively expanding the territory of the Sultanate in wars against neighbouring kingdoms. Before he had even taken to the throne, when he was still loyal to his uncle and father-in-law, Alauddin had raided Devagiri, the capital of the Yadava kingdom. There he had forced the king, Ramachandra, to a peace treaty, as the king's army was away from the city at the time with the crown prince Simhana. But as the treaty was being drawn up, Simhana returned with this army. And when Alauddin managed to defeat that army too, it meant that he could impose a much harsher demand for tributes in the eventual treaty. And the Hindu king Ramachandra became a vessel of the Muslim Alauddin. And when Alauddin usurped the throne later that year, he was forced to pay him tribute. And it wasn't just money and authority that Ramachandra offered to his suzerain. He also gave him the hand of his daughter, Jatyapali. Now, this was sometime around the time he became sultan in 1296. Alauddin and Jatyapali had two sons, Qutbuddin, today's Badgay, and his little brother, Shihabuddin Omar. But they weren't Alauddin's only children. He already had two sons with a previous wife, including a guy named Khizr Khan, who was his nominated heir and successor.
Okay, so our guy was never originally supposed to take the throne.
A third son, at least, yeah.
Okay.
So heir, spare, and then, warlord. Alauddin's reign was not just about conquest. As well as expanding the kingdom, he also reformed it socially and economically. This was a matter of self-preservation in reality. In order to field a massive army, including almost 500,000 horsemen.
Oh, wow, that's huge.
Yeah. And using these in both aggressive wars outside his borders and against internal revolt inside, he needed a very well-managed economy. So the administration of tax collection was improved and taxes were formalized and brought under his government control.
He sounds like a right party boy.
Yeah.
Thanks. Here come the tax collectors. Ooh.
You might call him pious with what comes next. You might call him boring. Alauddin did his best to tax and kind of just to reduce the numbers of the sort of mid-ranking elites of nobles, and especially Hindu chiefs and landowners in Gujarat. And he did that in order to, I guess, remove their power base and their ability to revolt against him.
Right. Those are alternate power bases and sources of potential rebellion.
Yeah. And if people are poor and struggling to pay their tax, then within a certain level, then they have less ability to wage war. But actually, it wasn't a universally unpopular thing to do. These sort of poor rural populations might have actually welcomed being relieved of the duty of supporting this class of the nobility, although they soon found themselves working tooth and nail just to meet the Sultan's enormous tax burden. And fun in general was largely off the menu with him.
Oh, this guy sounds like a right treat.
Yeah. He prohibited the sale of alcohol, any sort of use of cannabis. Yeah. He banned gambling. Yeah. Magicians, sorcerers, sex work, and new punishments were introduced for adultery. Castration for the man. That deserves that. And execution for the woman.
Ah!
Yeah. So these social...
So this is a, extremely religious, banning all fun, enthusiastic tax collector.
Yeah.
Wow. Sounds like an absolute recipe for vast public popularity and party time.
I mean, the one thing you can say for him, though, is this sort of combination of social reform. No, it's going to sound like me sound like a fascist, but the social reform combined with the sort of suppressing of his own sort of nobility meant stability for a lot of people.
Yeah, in this sort of unified, national body of sorts, where the honor of the people is reflected in the honor of the leadership, and high taxes bind everyone together like sticks into some sort of a bundle.
Yeah. But then this is also telling as well. So to implement these social and market reforms, he used and developed a large, terrifying, and much feared system of spies, of espionage against his own people. He also implemented market reforms, however, which did help to regulate the lives of his subjects. And that included fixed prices on everything from grain to beef, silk, sugar, sesame oil, horses, and slaves. So here's the government-controlled price list for enslaved people. It included female slave for domestic work, 5 to 12 tankers, female slave for concubinage, 20 to 40 tankers, and handsome young male slave, 20 to 30 tankers.
Okay, Hugh, I have two questions for you. One, so sex work is banned, but buying a female slave for concubinage is allowed and is actually a government set price?
Right. So to understand this, you have to understand that slavery is like a form of social class. It's about a relationship between people. It's a horrible situation to be in, but it's not the same as perhaps you might understand slavery during the transatlantic slave trade, which is implemented by extreme violence to produce just workers, labor.
It's not chattel slavery.
It's not chattel slavery. It's like a different form of slavery. And of course, when you look at something and say like, well, if you own this person, you're allowed to have sex with them and be an adulterer with them, et cetera, but if you just pay them, you can't. Well, the difference there, of course, is a class-based thing as well.
Right. So it's about freemen, like free people versus unfree people.
Right, yeah.
Second question. How come the women slaves are described in terms of what they can do and the male slaves are only described as handsome?
Well, that's really interesting, actually. That's a good point because slavery obviously was this intrinsic part of the society, but there was a distinction, as you can see in this list, between a female slave's labor and a male slave's beauty. So the scholar Indrani Chatterjee, who is an expert on gender and slavery in Indian history, writes that in contemporary literature and poetry of the time, quote, "The characteristics of slaves were almost inevitably discussed in terms of male beauty, female skill, and the eunuch's moral stature."
Okay.
So they performed different roles within society. It's not chattel slavery. And also the social status of slave, although it was very punitive and took you out of control and also very infantilizing. Chatterjee also talks a lot about how words for boy and slave are sort of put together. And so you can be regarded as a boy in your 20s and 30s and 40s as a slave. It's kind of delinked almost from that gender age relationship. But having said that, the social status of being a slave didn't necessarily limit your potential for advancement in that society. So take, for example, Malik Kafur, who was a Gujarati slave who will play a very important role in Qutbuddin's rise to power. So Kafur was taken as war booty, as plunder, by Alauddin during his invasion of Gujarat. You should remember the year that he sort of took to the throne. And he was a prize trophy for the Sultan. According to stories at the time, he cost his original owner the apocryphal amount of 1,000 Hazar denarii, which was a huge amount of money at the time. It's probably not true that he paid that much, but it's just a sort of metaphor for how valuable he was. And he was valuable because he was seen as a particularly handsome eunuch. And so within the court, he rose very quickly to become at first a respected advisor and then a military commander who Alauddin then put in control of numerous campaigns in the south. So as you can see here, like the social status of a slave is not the same as chattel slavery in the European colonies. And when I say that Alauddin liked Malik Kafur, I mean he really liked Malik Kafur. According to contemporary historian Zaiduddin Barani, who had lived through both their reigns, the Sultan, quote, The Sultan loved the Malik Naib very much. He made him the commander of his army, a minister. He raised him above all the others. The heart of this sodomite beloved of his was soon corrupted.
The heart of this sodomite beloved of his was soon corrupted. Wow. The term sodomite, is that coming in through the translation? Like, what's the source of that? Because this is not...
Yeah, all this stuff I'm quoting here comes obviously in translation because I don't speak the languages, but I'm taking it from Indian authors who have translated it, obviously, and writing about it. Sodomite is obviously makes sense very much within like this sort of Western, I mean, the word Sodom, of course, comes from the Abrahamic religions in that way. But I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of the descriptions of their relationships at the time are very graphic. They're not making hints at what people's activities were. They're saying this person liked to be fucked up the ass in various ways. So sodomite probably means sodomite.
Got it.
So Kafur encouraged the Sultan to remove nobles from his court who he thought was threatening his authority. And the Sultan, it seemed to everyone around him, was dying. He fell into this sickness. According to Barani, quote, "In those 4 or 5 years when the Sultan was losing his memory and his senses, he had fallen deeply and madly in love with the Malik Naib. He'd entrusted the responsibility of the government and the control of the servants to this useless, ungrateful, ingratiate sodomite."
Useless, ungrateful, ingratiate sodomite. I'm going to have it written on my grave.
When Kafur's influence was challenged by Alp Khan, a powerful noble whose daughters had actually married Alauddin's older sons, Kafur concocted this plot and persuaded the Sultan to have Alp Khan killed and his own eldest sons blinded.
So is this how our guy comes to power? Because the alternatives have been blinded?
In a way, yeah. That was the purpose of blinding them, was to stop them inheriting. And so as Alauddin lay on his deathbed, Kafur called a meeting of advisors to the bedside, and he declared Alauddin's youngest son, Shihabuddin Omar, as the Sultan's new heir. And then he was going to rule as regent in his stead until he became an adult.
How convenient.
Yeah, he's not really convincing anyone there, because the boy was about 5 years old. So, that's another 10 years at least until he's out of there. The Sultan was sort of lying there in his bed. And apparently the Sultan's silence was taken as consent for this idea by all those who were attending. And not the fact he was dying. It's a kind of Weekend at Bernie's with the Sultan.
Ay, ay, ay.
And he died very shortly afterwards. And so Kafur then started trying to sort of consolidate power. So first he exiled the dead Sultan's senior queen, his first wife, the mother of the elder sons. And then he married Jatyapali, who was Qutbuddin's mother. And Qutbuddin himself was then imprisoned. And according to the historian Abraham Ereli, Kafur then sent his bodyguards to Qutbuddin in order to blind him too. But the young prince reminded them of his sort of loyal service to their former sultan and persuaded that they should rebel against him, against Kafur. So he sent them back to Kafur, where they murdered the former slave general.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he'd managed to hold power for barely a month.
That's a convincing young man that we're talking about here.
Yeah. So the nobles then released Qutbuddin ostensibly to act as a regent. They asked him to act as a regent for his younger brother. And at first, quite sensibly, he declined because he'd grown up around these court intrigues of Alauddin and Kafur, and he feared for his life if he was to have any power at all. But the young man, who was now about 17 or 18, he relented. And from the start of his reign, he was very clear he knew not to trust turncoats at all, even those who'd defected to his side. And so he had Kafur's bodyguards, the ones who'd killed Kafur on his behalf, he had them killed.
Ah.
So you start to see the start of his own brutal reign here, I guess. And Kafur's name really became mud. According to that historian Balani, quote, "This ignorant man did not know that to be castrated, to be addicted to the vice of being sodomized, and to be faithless are the worst vices."
Some of my best friends are addicted to the vice of being sodomized, Hugh.
He did not know that the necessities and rules of kingship require a person to be exceptional, independent, fearless, generous, and strong. The few days of power intoxicated him.
As they so often do.
So Qutbuddin's style of rule was really the polar opposite of his late father's. He returned lands that his father had seized back to the landlords, winning their support. He removed the price controls, which wouldn't have supported the merchants and the traders. And he renounced many of the prohibitions on sex, music, and alcohol to the support of probably everyone else.
Party time.
Yep. He also released thousands of prisoners. He gave his soldiers enormous bonuses. And he dismantled that surveillance state that kept the wheels on the road.
But Hugh, our show is called Bad Gays, not Good Gays. What are we doing here?
It's a mixed bag. It's a curate's egg of gays.
All right, here we go.
So his rule really, well, by Barani's account, Barani is a Muslim theorist and historian writing sort of at the time or just after his death. But by Barani's account, this became really an increasingly debauched party at which Mubarak Shah was kind of the reveler in chief.
Once again, sounds like good gays to me.
quote, the Sultan attended to nothing but drinking, listening to music, debauchery and pleasure, scattering gifts and gratifying his lusts. The Sultan plunged into sensual indulgences openly and publicly, by day and by night, and the people followed his example. His whole life was passed in extreme dissipation and utter negligence. Debauchery, drunkenness and shamelessness proved his ruin. He cast aside all regard for decency and presented himself decked out in the trinkets and apparel of a female before his assembled company. He gave up attendance at public prayer and publicly broke the fast of the month of Ramadan.
Shades of Elagabalus here.
Shades of Elagabalus, yeah, the appearing in female attire, let's say.
Sort of breaking all of the possible virtues of kingly or courtly masculinity.
And religious taboos, yeah. And right. According to the historian Erly, he would also appear naked at meetings of his advisors.
That's great.
Just turning up to a conference room completely butt naked and also using foul language and encouraging his advisors to use foul language.
Well, you know what? That was his fucking right, okay? I don't know. I've somehow have sympathy for this guy from the way that you're telling this story, but maybe we're going to take a turn pretty soon.
Yeah, I'll hold you to that later.
All right.
So these reforms, and probably, of course, the fun that came with them and that accompanied his reign, made him quite popular. And has to be said, he was extremely lucky because his father had implemented all these reforms like out of necessity. He had to suppress internal Hindu dissent. He had to repel Mongol invasion. He had to fight these territorial wars. But the major military and territorial issues of Mubarak Shah's reign were really quickly resolved. So he didn't have to field these armies or maintain his control. There was this army rebellion in Gujarat during Kufar's brief rule that he suppressed largely by just convincing the rebels to lay down their arms. And then he introduced this new governor who was called Zafar Khan, who sort of brought the province into line and it became an effective economic base, I guess. And the journey, sort of chaotic end of Alauddin's reign, the Yadava kingdom, which he'd sort of brought to heel at the start of his reign as a vassal state and whose princess he'd had married, Mubarak Shah's mum, it managed to regain its independence. And so Mubarak Shah really wanted to reclaim this kingdom as his suzerain. After all, it was his mum's place. So he marched this large army down to the capital, and all but two of the Hindu chiefs then swore fealty to him, and there was no battle.
Okay, what about the other two, though?
So the two who refused, they refused to acknowledge his suzerainty, they retreated up into the mountains. And if he was going to suppress a rebellion effectively, he would, of course, have to chase them into the mountains.
But that sounds less fun than a big debauched party.
Well, yeah. I don't know about you, but when I have a job I need to do like that, say getting a book from a high shelf or getting a coffee when I'm hungover or undoing the lid on a jar of pickles, I just get my boyfriend to do it.
Of course, yeah. That's it there for.
Well, that's what Mubarak Shah did as well. He sent Hassan, who was his boyfriend, as leader of an enormous army, and he managed to capture the rebel commander, Harapala Deva, and then bring him back to Mubarak Shah, where he was executed and his body was hung from the city gates.
I think we should hold Joao and Corey to the standard next time they complain about doing some little task around the house. Well, what have you done for me lately? I want my enemies taken from their hiding place in the mountain and brought down here immediately.
Well, let's talk about the boyfriend, Hassan. So we're back here in Delhi, Party City. Life is in full swing.
Go back to Party City where you belong.
Yeah. According to Barani, in Delhi at the time, quote, "The whole world became given to leisure. The ways of the world changed. Fear of the monarchy began disappearing from the hearts of the people. Many people gave up their abstinence and said farewell to virtuous lives. The interest in worship that people had developed also lessened. Even obligatory duties began to be ignored. Mosques began losing their congregations. Since the emperor was constantly and flagrantly involved in impiety and immorality, the people followed his example. New young men began to make their appearance. All the beautiful singers returned to the city. The price of young male slaves, beautiful eunuchs, and beautiful slave girls went up to 500, 1,000, 2,000 tankers."
Wait, so earlier we were talking about the prices under his father being like 15, 20, 40, and now we're talking about thousands?
Yeah, this is a sort of unbearable eunuch inflation.
Thanks, Joe Biden.
So two of those slaves were a pair of half-brothers, Hindus, actually, who had converted to Islam when they'd been captured and brought to Delhi. And they were named Hasan and Husamuddin. They'd arrived in Delhi, actually, during the reign of Alauddin, when they were young men. And they were raised in the court by one of his nobles, Malik Shadi. And Mubarak Shah became very enamored with both of them, in fact. And he took them both as his lovers, although he had a favorite, which was Hasan. About his sex life, really. Mubarak Shah was bisexual. He maintained a very large harem of young women, and he seemed to be fond of all sorts of sexual practices with women. According to this later Persian historian, Farishta, he enjoyed, quote, "leading a gang of abominable prostitutes stark naked along the terraces of the royal palaces and obliging them to make water upon the nobles as they entered the court."
My God.
So there you were, arriving to see your naked sultan swearing at you. And as you walked through the door, a prostitute standing on the window ledge would piss over you. So he was debauched.
We really are in the land of Elagabalus here.
Very much so, yes. Completely unhinged.
Yeah.
But he definitely preferred, sexually, it seems he preferred men, and especially Hasan. Again, according to Barani, quote, "there was a boy called Hasan from the people of Bawa who had been brought up by one of Alauddin's important nobles. The emperor became crazy about him, and within a year of his enthronement gave him special and high honors. He also gave him the title of Khusrau Khan. In the indifference and recklessness of youth, he even handed over Malik Naib's troops and lands to the son of the Barawars. He went further in his giddiness and temerity. He even had him made a minister. In spite of his youth and his lustfulness, he had become so enamored by Hasan, the son of a Barawar, that he did not want to be parted from him for a moment."
Huh. So he's really, what's interesting to me here is that these historians are actually really emphasizing the youth and inexperience of Mubarak Shah, as well as the other guy. Like, he's like his own evil twink, in love with another evil twink.
Well, that's interesting. We can get to this a bit later. But actually, I think it's, there's something different going on here, which is this relationship between the slave and the free man, and then that becoming used as a metaphor for love and lust. And so the free man is kind of the same as in Roman Greece, is seen as this sort of rational, in control civilian, and a slave is a sort of not quite a barbarian, but someone who is outside of the concept of a citizen, who can be abused and mistreated and had sex with against their will. But when you become so enamored by love and lust, then you become enslaved to something else.
Right.
So
you become like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I believe you when you say he was bisexual in the harem, whatever. And I also know that we're talking about extremely different times and places, but I want to say that having a group of hookers piss on nobles as they enter the palace is really deranged gay guy behavior, like of a kind that I can recognize. We've all known people who would do that absolutely if you made them sultan.
I mean, it's also, you know, giving Freddie Mercury and I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but we do actually have corroborating evidence of how hot Hasan must have been, because he's mentioned incredibly in the writings of Ibn Battuta, who was the Maghrebi explorer and traveler who journeyed across the entire world at the time from Tangier to Beijing.
Oh, wow. And Hasan was one of its multiple wonders.
Well, yeah. And he visited the court but after Mubarak Shah's death. Ibn Battuta described him as, quote, "a fine looking man. And I looked into it, yeah, and Batutha didn't actually visit in Delhi until 15 years after Hassan's death. So either you take that as a pinch of salt, he's been told this story done some by someone else, or reflect that maybe this guy was so fucking hot that when this strange traveler who is voyaging across the entire known world visits your city, having visited, you know, the Hagia Sophia and the Golden Horde and the Great Mosque of Kilwa Kisiwani, and he says, well, what's worth knowing here about your city? And you go, well, there was this really hot guy who lived here 15 years ago. He's like, that's how hot he was. So I don't know.
Okay.
But Hassan, who from now on we'll call Khusrau Khan, because that's his new name, he became really increasingly powerful in the court. He became the commander of this vast army that he'd inherited from the past slave general. And he became the chief advisor to the Sultan, as well, of course, as being his lover and, importantly, the passive partner in the bedroom. And the Sultan loved fucking him. And he, when he couldn't fuck him because he was away on his military campaigns, instead he fucked his brother, Hasimuddin, instead. And he'd also send for Khusrau Khan when he was off fighting his campaigns and saying, I'm so horny, I need you to come back right now. And he'd be brought back across India to have sex with him. And so at the same time, these two brothers attempted to consolidate their own power. And they did that largely by, quote unquote, warning Mubarak Shah about threats to his power.
Oh, this is such a predictable pattern.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a predictable pattern in history, but when exactly the same thing happened to your own father.
And also think, when you decided, you got into this business and you said, I am not going to get wrapped up in court intrigue.
Yeah.
I can't do all of this. I just want to be the fun party king. And then all of a sudden, you end up, through love, ending up having the two random brother slaves that you elevated into vastly important ministers because you love fucking them so much, having you... execute your other ministers.
Yeah, your other ministers, yeah. Right. And really, his pleasure in this debauchery did seem to be matched by his cruelty when it came to his paranoia.
This is the part where all of my stuff earlier about how nice this guy seemed is going to come back to bite me in the ass, isn't it?
That's putting it mildly. Uh-oh. So on finding that these plots against him, he'd kill not just the plotters, but their entire families.
Oh, God.
And in fact, he'd kill his entire family. He had his remaining brothers executed, their bodies mutilated, dumped in a ditch. And according to Ibn Battuta, when he discovered that some nobles were planning to replace him with his own nephew, the infant son of his brother, Khazir Khan, who he'd had killed, he, quote, seized him, the nephew, the baby, seized him by the feet and dashed his head against a stone until his brains were scattered.
Ah.
And then he went on to marry his brother Khazir Khan's wife, Deval Devi.
She must have been thrilled.
Yeah, passed from one sort of tyrannical brother to the next.
Yeah, to the next one who just murdered your child in front of you. God.
So according to Barani, quote, acts of violence and tyranny like this became common practice. The good qualities which the Sultan possessed were now all perverted. He gave way to wrath and obscenity, to severity, revenge, and heartlessness. He dipped his hands in innocent blood and he allowed his tongue to utter disgusting and abusive words to his companions and attendants. A violent, vindictive spirit possessed him.
What happened to the nice party king?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned earlier that he'd appointed his father-in-law, Zafar Khan, to be the government of Gujarat when he'd suppressed the rebellion there.
Yeah, and that he did a pretty good job.
He did a very good job of it. So despite doing an excellent job, being a very good governor, he had him executed for no reason whatsoever, and then gave his second-best boyfriend, Husamuddin, the job instead.
Oh, brilliant decision-making.
Brilliant decision-making to take a slave who you'd forced to convert from Hinduism to Islam, enslave him, force him to have sex with you, and then make him the governor of a largely Hindu state or Hindu region.
Uh-oh.
So Husamuddin didn't do an excellent job. As soon as he got into power as the governor of Gujarat, he became an apostate. He rejected Islam, his new adopted religion. He reverted to Hinduism. And now, of course, the governor's role was specifically to suppress and control any Hindu revolt in that region. And so the nobles had him arrested and taken to Delhi in chains to be dragged in front of the Sultan for punishment.
Uh-oh.
So there, the Sultan takes one look at him, slaps him across the face, and then has him unchained and promotes him inside the palace.
What?
Yeah, like he just he just learns nothing from his father's life and, importantly, death. You know, there was a lesson which should have been, if you have to take a beautiful enslaved convert boy from another province to become your lover and forcibly convert him, and then you fall hopelessly in love with him, and then you promote him, and he attains great power, do be aware that he might actually also want to take your throne, which is a pretty specific lesson.
It's an extremely specific lesson, and it's the exact same thing. And you also mentioned at the beginning that he says when he first took power, he didn't trust any turncoats, even to the point where he had the people who
get
him. And now you have someone who like turns on you in directly after being made governor, and you just like you're like, oh well.
Yeah, but he really wants to fuck him. But another,
you can do that without making him governor of Gujarat. Oh my god.
Well, another.
How many lovers have you had who you've never made governor of any place? Isn't it possible?
Yeah, but I might have done if I had the possibility. Anyway, another big problem was that. Khusrau Khan and his brother didn't want to be Mubarak Shah's lovers. Khusrau Khan specifically detested detested getting fucked. And according to Barani, he publicly, he quote, offered his body to the Sultan like an immoral and shameless woman, but within himself he was seething with anger and choking on a desire for revenge at the way the Sultan forced himself upon him and took advantage.
Ugh.
Which is fair enough feeling to have, to be honest.
Yeah.
In her essay, Alienation, Intimacy and Gender, Problems for a History of Love in South Asia, Indrani Chatterjee looks at what this form of a sort of one-way slave-master dynamic would have meant in the culture of a sultanate. So right. Much like in ancient Greece, the relationships between men were very strictly coded on the basis of status.
Right.
Quote, sex appears as an enactment of social and political hierarchies. The dominant is construed as the insertive partner and a subordinate as the receptive one. So again, it's similar to, as we'd understand in Greek and Roman cultures, we were talking about in the Elagabalus episode. This sort of dynamic whereby the free male is permitted to have sex with other men so long as they were enslaved and also passive is very clear.
And Mubarak Shah, unlike Elagabalus, I mean, there's a lot of similarities with Elagabalus in terms of public taboo breaking and appearing in feminine clothing, but from what you're saying, it seems like he's still not breaking that ultimate taboo and being open about enjoying bottoming.
No, and in fact, he doesn't.
He's a top.
He's a top, yeah. And so he sticks with, within that part of the sex gender system. But I think what is interesting in accounts like Barani's is how this act of desire that he just does desire him is then also read, as I was saying before, through the figure of the slave. That in falling for someone through lust, these figures like Mubarak Shah and his father are seen to become slaves to their own desire to love. And as a result, they lose their agency as autonomous intellectual figures and they lose their status as high-ranking kings in some way because they've given up this essential control.
Right.
They've become slaves themselves.
To quote the theorist Britney Spears, I'm a slave for you.
Right.
But I think we also shouldn't just make jokes and coast over the fact that we're talking, in the case of these two brothers, about what appears to be, from their perspective, basically years of
sexual abuse.
And abuse. Right.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
But on... Well, yeah, Chatterjee writes quite interestingly about this, actually. She says, writing in old age and poverty and attempting to legitimize the reign of the Tughlaqs who succeeded the Khalji's, Barani's history was also structured by adab, that's the Arabic word. Any good Muslim history was required to instruct the community of the faithful. Sodomy was condemned in the Quran and Hadith, traditions of the Prophet, and there was also an old Arabic tradition of depicting love as lust that incites to evil. So energizing the motif of sodomy in the case of the Khalji rulers, Barani suggests that the akeli, means intellect, that which leads one to submit to Allah, had been overpowered by their obsessive and base attachments. And what's also interesting in this essay is she says that there's, again, this elision between the sort of age and the status of slavery, so that when people are writing poems about slave, quote, boys, the word for boy also can be understood as a word for slave. So talking about boys, slave boys, actually can be men in their 30s and 40s who are the subjects of this desire.
Right. That makes sense.
The infantilization of enslaved peoples is, of course, like a big part of the social status and a social system that keeps intend to dehumanize and keep them under control. So anyway, down in Gujarat, Khusrau Khan, where his brother was the new governor, had been a governor, Khusrau Khan was now busy raising an army of Hindu chiefs and soldiers of his own. And he persuaded the Sultan to allow him to bring some of his supporters to Delhi, because he says, you know, all these other nobles, they've got their families and friends, and I don't have anyone, poor me. And so it was within this nucleus of supporters, along with some sort of disgruntled officers, that he started to plot his coup. So originally he'd planned to kill the Sultan on a hunting trip, but his friends and advisors suggested that the plotters would probably be easily defeated out in the countryside. Best to kill him in his palace. So then he persuaded the Sultan to give him the keys to the palace gates so that he could have his friends visit him.
Stupid, stupid. Do you never give the evil twink a key to your flat?
And of course, Mubarak Shah, quote, intoxicated as he was in lust, gave them to him. So not to be a victim blamer, but at this stage, he really deserves to be cooed.
And also, you know, there's other things that he's done. Victim in this situation is complicated when you think about what's been going on between the two of them. So,
yeah, that's true. So one of the Sultan's closest advisors, Ziauddin, then warned the Sultan in no uncertain terms exactly what Khusrau Khan was planning. And I'll quote a little bit actually here from Barani because it's so good. Quote, "This unfortunate Sultan, who was submerged up to his neck in sexual desire, in his foolishness and with great carelessness, told this father murderer that Qazi Ziauddin was telling me such and such about you. He, who was used to lying under men in order to deceive, pretended to cry and wail. He told the Sultan that since he'd been so kind to him, and because he'd raised him above the senior nobles, all the nobles and the members of the royal household hated him and were trying to get him murdered.
Oh, poor baby.
A surge of passion engulfed the Sultan at the coquettish crying and wailing of the delicate one. He took him in his arms and hugged him, kissed him on the lips and threw him onto the floor and did what he had to do. In this state, when it's easy to risk one's life, the Sultan told him, even if the entire world is turned upside down and if all those who are close to me say things against me, I am so much in love and maddened by you that I will sacrifice all of them for one hair of yours. Believe me, I will not believe a word against you, no matter who says it."
Stupid.
We've all been there.
It's called dickful thinking.
He did what needed to be done. So the end is, of course, inevitable. One night soon after, a group of soldiers led by Khusrau Khan's captain stormed through the palace gates. The Sultan is in bed with Khusrau Khan, and he sends him to see what the noise is about. And he looks out the window and he says, "Don't worry, it's just some horses who've slipped their bridles and the men are sort of trying to round them up. You know, go back to bed, honey." But finally, it clicks for Mubarak Shah. He puts on his slippers and he makes a dash.
Now,
yeah. Jesus, he realizes what's happening. He puts on his slippers and he makes a dash for the harem to try and hide in there. And Khusrau Khan jumps on him and pulls his hair. And the Sultan struggles with him and pins him to the ground. But the little hussy won't let go of his hair. He's still gripping onto him. And at that moment, the rebels enter the room and hit him in the back with an axe. And his head is cut off and his body is thrown out into the palace courtyard. And the men enter the harem and begin to commit numerous atrocities, killing some of the Sultan's wives and ridding Khusrau Khan of any rivals to the throne. And Khusrau Khan then gathers all the nobles together in the court and he begins negotiations. At first, he suggests putting one of Mubarak Khan's infant sons on the throne and he will rule as a regent.
Oh my God. First as tragedy, then as farce.
That sounds familiar. This is the third potential regent for a child we've had so far. But then he decides it'd be better if he, as boyfriend and murderer of the Sultan, continues the family dynasty. And incredibly, the nobles agree.
What?
Yeah. Now, as always with sources, it's very important to acknowledge these biases and limitations. And we really see it, of course, in Barani's account of Khusrau Khan's coup. Barani is an Islamic scholar and the usurpation of power by a Hindu for as soon as the Sultan was dead, he renounced his Islamic faith, of course, as his brother had. That especially angered him. So his writing on Khusrau Khan's time as a Sultan is, of course, full of anti-Hindu invective.
Right.
He writes, quote, "The flames of violence and cruelty reached up to the skies. Copies of the holy book were used as seats and idols were set up in the pulpits of mosques. Hindus rejoiced greatly, boasting that Delhi had once more come under Hindu rule." But Khusraw Khan, like his predecessor, had attempted to placate any insurrection amongst the nobles through these generous gifts and payments to soldiers. And he even married his dead boyfriend's wife, that poor woman, Devel Deli, who had originally been Mubarak Shah's brother's wife.
Oh, God.
And this was, I guess, an attempt to gain some legitimacy for his claim to the dynasty. However, one noble, a military commander named Ghazi Malik, was so appalled to know that the Sultanate was now ruled by a Hindu. And he was actually in Punjab on campaign. And his son was still in Delhi. So he'd smuggled his son out of Delhi, fearing, of course, he might be killed. And then he launched his own insurrection. And Malik was a highly experienced and talented general. And he took his armies towards Delhi. Khusraw Khan fielded his own army, commanded, of course, by his brother, Husamuddin. And Barani writes, quote, "So these two foolish, ignorant lads went forth like newly hatched chickens just beginning to fly to fight with a veteran warrior like Ghazi Malik, who 20 times had routed the Mongols." So really, they stood very little chance. And they were routed in battle, and then they retreated to Delhi to prepare for a counterattack. And there, Khusraw Khan was finally defeated in battle just outside the city, less than 2 months after the coup. He was found cowering in a garden, hiding from his pursuers, and he was put to death. Barani writes, quote, "The effeminate wretch could not bear the attack of men." Which I'm not sure is true. Anyway, Malik then restored Islam to the Sultanate, and he ruled as Sultan for 5 more years. I'm interested in this playing up of Khusraw Khan's effeminacy, actually, because it's used, I think, by Barani exactly to prove that point about how deeply enslaved the Sultan had become to his passions, sort of further tying Khusraw Khan's sort of sexual passivity to this subordinate gender role too. And so, like, he's sort of saying, like, the Sultan was, like, so dumbstruck by his desires that he threw away his kingdom, not for a man, but, like, for a gay boy, you know, not for someone of equal intellect or brutality, but like someone who's transgressing even the gender norms.
Right.
Chatterjee writes, quote, "Barani emphasizes that the kingdom can be lost when free adult men allow themselves to become dependent on slaves, thus subverting the appropriate domination of slave by master," end quote. So with that in mind, I will leave the last word, of course, to our friend Barani. He says, quote, "In the way Alauddin and Qutbuddin were destroyed by Malik Naib and Khusraw Khan, the wise and those looking for lessons will see the results of pampering young men and catamites." Amen to that. You're listening to Bad Gaze, a podcast all about evil and complicated queer people in history. And we'd just like to take a moment to thank all our supporters over on Patreon.
Yeah, it wouldn't be possible without you, and that's why we now have, for Patreon supporters and Apple Podcast subscribers, a new monthly podcast called Extra Bad Gaze, and that's where we have more informal but still informed conversations about hot topics, current issues, current events, current culture, but we do it with that same analysis that makes the show. So this last month, we just talked about this new gay Fire Island nightmare community that they want to build in the Mediterranean. But it ended up becoming a much deeper conversation about the history of gentrification, about gay men's complicity in it, about how it affects queer communities. And that's the kind of analysis you can expect from the show, along with, episodes about Diva Down George Santos and our favorite and least favorite gay Christmas movies.
And if you still feel like you haven't had your fill of Bad Gaze, why not check out our book, which is available now, Bad Gaze, A Homosexual History, in hardback or paperback. And it's also now available in Italian translation and coming soon in Thai and in Spanish.
And that's at badgazepod.com/book. And our Patreon is patreon.com/badgazepod, or click subscribe in Apple Podcasts. Back to the show.
Well, thanks for that story, Hugh. I want to start by asking, there's been a few jarring tonal shifts in this episode and in the way that we talk about the relationship between Hassan and Mubarak Shah. How do you think we should understand that relationship? Because on the one hand, we're told that this is something that Hassan does not want, right? Which suggests a long pattern of abuse or even rape. On the other hand, it seems like, or maybe not on the other hand, but in addition, it seems like we're seeing someone who is extremely intentionally using the degree of infatuation that the king has for him and the brother as well in order to build independent power bases, and at the end really kind of deploying it in this act of rebellion.
Well, it's very difficult to know because the account we have comes from Barani, who is also just, as well as sort of trying to tell the story, is also trying to set up a metaphor for kingship. So, so on the one level, we have like the basic fact that the relationship was fundamentally unequal because it's between a king and a slave, although a slave has to be obviously seen in the context of slavery within the Sultanate, the type of social role of a slave, but still a slave who's not regarded, I guess, as fully deserving of the rights and privileges of a free person. But then you also have this level of this idea that he's trying to push, which is that in falling for his own lust, in falling, becoming sort of enslaved by his own lust, he's weakening the king. The Sultan is weakening his grip on the kingdom, and so for that to work, as I think, as a metaphor, the idea that he would fall for someone who has no love towards him is like evidence of how much he's been weakened by lust, right? So, mm-hmm. So we don't like perhaps they were in love with each other. But in the retelling, Barani can just flip it because it doesn't sound so good, which is that he'd like fallen out of his lover. Like it's not the falling out that matters. It's the very fact that he was infatuated with lust right. for a man.
It's also interesting to me that the Barani wants to have both ways, right? On the one hand, he talks about how this person is, in his heart, he hated it and et cetera. And on the other hand, when he's captured, he's like, here's this like crouching effeminate.
Yeah, and he's degraded. Yeah, and he's degraded, and yeah, these right. other things. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So like, of course, in looking at the facts as we know them, then obviously, like, there's a implicit brutality in the relationship. But they're interpreting those further about the true nature of the relationship. Like, I'm not going to say like, oh, they're great lovers and the story has been corrupted over the years. Like, I don't, that's probably also not the case, but the telling of it is, of course, probably deeply biased by the times that the historian was living in.
Do stories like this end up being used in any kind of explicit way by later British colonists to justify the colonization of India as a kind of moral project?
I don't know about that, but one thing in the Chatterjee essay that's very interesting is she talks about how there is the British coming in have a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of those same-sex relationships as they exist within that society, which is unsurprising. Like, of course, they just seeing as sodomites, and it is used, and that in itself is used to justify colonization. But also, part of that is this same misunderstanding and purposeful mistranslation of these same concepts like boy and slave, which she talks about in later literature, which is very interesting. But of course, the other thing to note is that this is happening around 1300, so it's a good 300 years before British colonization even starts to get going in India.
Right, right. That makes sense.
Following the Mughal Empire.
All right. Well, if people want to learn more about the life of Mubarak Shah, where should they look? What are some of the sources you used to research this episode?
Well, of course, I can't read any of the primary sources in their original languages. So I used the work of a number of Indian historians and scholars, the main being Age of Wrath, A History of the Delhi Sultanate by Abraham Ereli, who I mentioned earlier. The book, a lot of the quotes from Barani come from the book Same-Sex Love in India, Readings from Literature and History by Ruth Anita and Salim Kidwai, and Alienation, Intimacy and Gender, Problems for the History of Love in South Asia by Indrani Chatterjee is from the book Queering India, Same-Sex Love and Eroticism in Indian Culture and Society, also edited by Ruth Anita.
Great. Well, that's our show. You can find me on the internet at Ben Writes Things or at benwritesthings.com.
And you can subscribe to my newsletter at hugh.substack.com.
And until next week, bye.
Bye. Bad.